Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Ken Weeks from Wormhole Riders. Welcome to You Decide. Today we have a very special guest host, Josh Blacker, who many of you know from Human Target, from Stargate Universe, and he's working on a new movie project called Elysium. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Every day is a good day so long as I wake up on the green side of the grass, my friend. It's very nice to hear your voice again. How's everything in Vancouver?
Things are great. The sun is shining today, so it's overall a pretty darn good day in Vancouver.
Outstanding. Today we also have with us Sandra Simpson, senior team leader, Josh, from the state of Georgia. She runs our new science website and formerly had worked with us for 2 years managing our fringe team. Hello, Sandra.
Hello. Hello, Josh. Welcome.
Hi, Sandra. Thank you so much.
Additionally, we have our Vampire Diary and Terra Nova team leader, Ms. Angela Crosby. She hails from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Angie.
Hello. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Angie.
Josh, I want to thank you for all the Wormhole Riders around the world for making your time available today. We're going to kind of dig in. We're going to talk about vegetarianism. Being a vegan, perhaps a little bit about your new movie project, and with your permission, we'll get started.
Sounds great.
How was it like working on Elysium?
It was an amazing project to work on so many different levels. Because the script was phenomenal. The story is just really interesting and creative and original story. Then, of course, working with Neil as a director was an absolute pleasure. He's a genius. He really is. And it was super fun to work with him. And then, of course, working alongside Matt Damon and Jodie Foster was, I think, any actor would envy. It was a real learning experience and just an honor to work alongside them.
Well, we know that it's still a little bit under wraps at Sony Pictures, but it seems to have a pretty large cast, including some old Stargate favorites. I understand Michael Shanks is involved in the project.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't see Michael or work with him, but I understand that he was on the film as well.
And Ona Grauer from Stargate Atlantis, where you also did some work, I believe, as a screaming tribesman one time?
Yeah, and Ona, as I understand, I actually spent one day on set with Ona. She was in Stargate Universe. She played Louis
Pipe. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great project. Are you excited about the upcoming release of this whenever it's announced?
Yeah, as I understand, they're looking at an early 2013 release,
yep.
February or March. I think people are going to be blown away. If anyone saw District 9, they understand the kind of movies that Neil wants to make. He wants to make exciting movies, but movies that also have a socio-political statement to them, and this movie will not disappoint. It really is off the charts good.
Well, it is. As a matter of fact, we embedded in your news story a couple of promo clips and a news report that it's kind of kind of like a District 9 follow-on, but it's going to be very exciting. Is there anything else that you are at liberty to share about Elysium at this time? I know that actors, we know that actors are under non-disclosure, but I think you tweeted a little bit that you did some filming in Mexico.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about it. I can't really talk much about the storyline and what it's about, but I have a supporting role in the movie, and I guess I can say that I play one of the villains. I think that's fair to say, and which seems to suit me. And we shot for 3 months here in Vancouver, and then they set up a camp in Mexico and shot down there for just over a month. We shot in Mexico City, which was really
exciting.
It was an experience.
You've always seemed to play, well, not always, but you played a fair amount of villains. Looking back on your Stargate Universe days, Sergeant Spencer was kind of, I don't know, I thought he was a good guy kind of a villain, to tell you the truth. And and then when go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Sergeant Spencer was, I think he was a good man who was unfortunately in a difficult situation, and one that I don't think a lot of people understand, this idea of addiction and depression and post-traumatic stress and all the things that go along with that. And as a Marine, I think he was trained to kill, and he knew that he was losing his mind, and instead of taking it out on other people, he decided to, of course, spoiler alert, end his own life, right?
Yes, he did. Well, also, I enjoyed you during your guest appearance in Human Target with Mark Valley. And you played kind of, once again, kind of a rogue character working for an organization that was, set against him. But in the end, you got shot in that. I had always hoped that Human Target would be picked up for one more season and that we might see you come back with the gang. But as you know, last year at WonderCon, they gave it a shot to see if they could pick it up, and unfortunately, no more Human Target.
Yeah, which is too bad. It was a good show, and the people on that show were great people. It was a great experience. But, you know, that's the nature of the beast when it comes to TV, right? It's a numbers game, and fortunately in Vancouver, it's been replaced. There's some other shows which are now shooting here, including Alcatraz, and, of course, Fringe still shoots here, and it looks like there's going to be a few new shows in the upcoming season that will be shot here. So fingers crossed that something develops on one of those.
Well, I hope that... we hope to see you in some of the new pilots that are being considered. We do follow Alcatraz. Are you a fan of Alcatraz? I know you were a fan of Fringe and auditioned at one point for a potential role. Do you watch the new Alcatraz series?
Yeah, you know what? I actually I did, because at first I'll watch a couple of episodes of any show that is shot here just so I get a sense of the feel and the look and the themes that they're going for on the show. And then some of them I continue to watch, and others I don't. And this, in Alcatraz, I really enjoyed. I think it's a neat story. I like J.J. Abrams. I think he does some really interesting things on television and tells some pretty good stories. And Jorge Garcia is terrific, I think. And Fringe, I've been a huge fan of Fringe since it started airing. And I actually just worked on it last week. This past week, I booked a little cameo in the hopes that maybe the character gets picked up, or if it doesn't get picked up for a fifth season, that at least I was on the show. I've always wanted to work with them.
Well, we had heard tell, and I'm glad that you're at liberty to discuss that, there's some other Vancouverites that are going to be appearing, and you may know or have heard of Gina Holden. She's got an upcoming guest appearance, and Tim Guinea, who played...
Yep.
In Stargate SG-1. He's got a coming up in episode 419. So there's been a lot of great guest stars this year, and Fringe is getting pretty darn exciting here. So we'll look forward to, are you at liberty to let us know where your cameo is going to be, at what episode number, or is that still under wraps?
Yeah. No, it's fine. It's episode 418.
418. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we're in hiatus now, so we're going to have to wait patiently for that one, Josh.
Yeah, I understand it'll be sometime in April, so.
Yep. Well, that's really great news. I'm glad you got the Fringe role. We've been waiting to see you on Fringe, and we'll be sure to be tweeting about you when episode 18 of season 4 airs.
Terrific. I appreciate all the support, Ken. Thank you so much.
Josh, originally you're from South Africa, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I was born in Johannesburg to a Welsh dad and an Irish-English mom.
How was it that you migrated or immigrated to Canada, to Vancouver?
You know what? It was a long process. We traveled on my parents' European passports, or British passports at the time, to make the process easier, but I moved here when I was 16, and it was before the elections and before things started to right themselves in South Africa. So it was right in the middle of the apartheid crackdown, and there was a lot of violence. And when you turn 18, you have to. At the time, there was a mandatory conscription. So my parents and I decided that my brothers and I didn't want to fight for a government that we didn't believe in. And as a conscientious objector, there was a six-year jail sentence associated with that. So we decided to move on. And Canada looked like we wanted to go to Australia or Canada or the UK. And Australia had a quarantine for animals. And we had a number of pets and didn't want to be away from them for a year, so we decided that Canada was the best option, and looking back, it's one of the best decisions we made, I think.
We've met some other people from South Africa. I don't know if you ever met Cliff Simon?
I haven't, no.
Oh, he's from South Africa, and stay tuned to WHRU Decide. There may be a surprise for the fans coming up in a few weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. What did you find to be the most striking differences for you immigrating from your native South Africa to a new country?
Wow. Well, the weather, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You grow up in Africa and you don't need antifreeze in your veins, and I still don't have it, and which is why Vancouver suits me just fine. It still gets pretty chilly, but snow was definitely a foreign concept when I first moved here. And, of course, just the freedoms that people enjoy in Canada that a lot of people in South Africa didn't enjoy. You know, where we grew up, there was a lot of violence and there was a lot of military presence. So you notice that right away, that there's a freedom that I think everyone in North America enjoys and sometimes we take for granted.
Wow. Well, I've always wanted to go to, that's one of the places I've never been to is South Africa, but your immigration went smoothly, and when you arrived in Vancouver, you became an attorney. Were you trained as an attorney before you arrived in Canada?
No, I acted as a child. I had an agent in South Africa, and I did a bunch of commercials and what have you, some TV. But when I came here, I always wanted to act, and I did my undergraduate degree. I started off with a BFA, a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Theater, and then of course I had this crisis of confidence that I wouldn't be able to make a living as an actor, so I went and got a changed degrees, got a political science and history degree, and said, well, I'm either going to go to law school or med school. I thought a profession would be a good way to go, and I always enjoyed a good debate, so I thought, well, let's go into law. And so I went to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and then started practicing in Alberta. And I practiced in Alberta for 4 years. I worked at a big firm, a big national firm, then I worked at a big local firm, then I worked at a small boutique firm. And I realized that it wasn't where I was practicing that was making me miserable, it was the fact that I was practicing. It's just not a career for me. And I decided that, you know, life is too short, and I really think you have to do what you love. So I decided to make the move to Vancouver and pursue a career as an actor.
Uh-huh. So do you still practice law at all or consult with anybody in the legal profession, or have you?
I don't practice anymore. I'm not called to the bar in Alberta or B.C. But on occasion, if I go an extended period of time without work, TV work, film work, I will often do some consulting for various firms on an ad hoc basis.
Well, years ago, before I got into high tech, I had applied to Pepperdine University in Southern California, and wanted to be an attorney. And then I was also a computer science major, and that's how I got into high tech. I think you know, at one time I was a professional stage actor as well.
Mm-hmm.
Couple friends of mine made it into the industry. Linwood Boomer, Little House on the Prairie, went on to be a producer, writer, director in Hollywood. But I couldn't get traction in that, and I went into support services here in the San Francisco Bay Area, working on films like Foul Play, series like Streets of San Francisco, Nash Bridges.
Right.
And then when it all moved to Vancouver, that's when I went into high tech. So I understand career changes. Some people might say that being a lawyer and acting are, you know, for a living, are really not that far apart. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think they're, I understand why people think that. The reality, however, is a different situation. I don't think they could be any further apart. Acting, well, I shouldn't say that necessarily. Being a lawyer is a very dry, process. It's about paperwork and finding and scouring for minutia and details of a situation. And I think, actually, now that I think about it, as I talk about it, I think really sometimes that's what acting is. But instead of scouring for words, we're looking for emotional connections and ideas about characters. So and getting the details of a character right, down to the tiny things as to what they wear, how they walk, what their relationship with brothers and sisters are like. So there's an investigative process in both of them. And ultimately, if you're a litigator and you go to court, I guess there's a performance aspect. So perhaps they're not as different as I originally thought.
Well, there's one of the things that I noticed when I was doing stage acting is, and then did some pre-law, as you know, there is a little bit of theater in the courtroom, right? You're playing to the judge, to the jury, and I leverage that, and I presume you feel the same way, is that some of that experience did bleed over into your acting career?
A little bit, and I think in the States, there's a little bit more opportunity to perform as counsel. As an attorney in Canada, our system is based on the British system, and it's a little bit more austere, so there isn't as much of that. But it's certainly there. I think you have to be persuasive, and you have to endear yourself to the jury or to the judge.
It's true. Well, America is rather litigious, but we won't go down that path right now. Josh, I believe Sandy has a question. Sandy, please go ahead with your question.
Okay, Josh, did growing up in South Africa, where you had little rights or not the rights that you have or the freedoms that you have in Canada right now, did that influence your decision to go into law to help fight for people's rights?
You know what? That's a great question, Sandy. Thank you. Mm-hmm. As a white kid growing up in South Africa during apartheid, I had it pretty good. Mm-hmm. But I saw around me a lot of injustices. And I think that definitely influenced my decision. I wanted to do something to help those who couldn't help themselves. And it's something that has been a theme throughout my life. I've always been a supporter of the underdog. I've always tried to help people in situations that are difficult for them. And of course, as we'll get into a little bit later, it informed my decision to become a vegan as well. So, yeah, I think the rights or lack of rights that I saw and the injustices I saw around me definitely influenced that decision.
Okay. Very admirable.
Oh, thanks.
When you decided to move into acting, did you jump right into acting, or did you pursue any acting career development or education of any kind before you became involved with acting?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, Ken?
When you moved from being a practicing attorney to act, did you was there any education that you pursued to become an actor?
Yeah, you know what? For the first year I lived here, I didn't do anything other than just train. I studied with a teacher here, and basically to get that muscle back and to start getting back into the groove of acting, because it had been a while since I'd been in theater school, and I think it's something that you need to do, and I still study. I still go to class, and I still read plays, and I think anybody who is a serious professional, whether you're Tiger Woods on the golf course or a brain surgeon at Mount Sinai, I think you're always improving, you're always studying, you're always learning. I think that's what keeps people at the top of their craft.
Aha. Okay. You're one of the, when we talked about this interview, I know that you're active in human interest in Canada. Matter of fact, I believe one of your most favorite charities is Jest for Joy at the Children's Hospital in Vancouver.
Yeah, it's not at the Children's Hospital just yet. Jest for Joy is an amazing organization. It's a clown doctoring organization started by a friend of mine, Allison Grant, and it's based on the work of Patch Adams. And what they do is they go into hospitals and in groups of as pairs, and they wear a red nose, but it's not full clown, but it's doctor characters that they create, and they go in to interact with patients and the family and friends of patients, not necessarily to make them laugh sometimes, but just sometimes to connect with them as humans, because the institution they're working at right now, the George Pearson Center, is a lifelong facility for people who have terminal illnesses, and so they just go and they sometimes connect with them, because these people may not see anybody for a week or have any interactions with anybody to lift their spirits. So the clown doctors do that, and we had a fundraiser for them just this past weekend, which was phenomenal success, and hopefully they'll be able to grow and perform and do their work in other hospitals around the Lower Mainland.
Well, that's great work. I know that when we interviewed you prior to the end of Stargate Universe, actually it was near the end of season one, when Sergeant Spencer went nonlinear and took his life aboard the Destiny. You had mentioned you were with Jess for Joy. So, are you one of the people that wears the clown face to cheer up the patients?
No, the clown doctors are they're all professionally trained actors. Allison, who started the organization, the charity, it's a charity. She's theatrically trained and trained as a clown doctor. There's a significant amount of training that goes into it, so that you can understand how to interact both, how to mesh both the artistic side and the medical side of things, so that you know when to go into a patient, when to dial it back, etc. So I admire the work they do, and it's incredibly draining, and I certainly don't do it, and I don't know that I would have the heart for it. I think it's heartbreaking the work they do. It really is.
Well, I know it's a good cause. Well, what we wanted to talk about today, recently, I believe in the last year or so, you gave up eating meat and became a vegetarian. So you're a vegetarian now, is that correct?
Actually, Ken, I've been a vegan, which is a strict vegetarian, for almost 19 years.
Wow. Now, I didn't know that from our previous interview. Well, that was where I wanted to go with this. When we were doing some research, and we were going to have a native of Alberta province, Patricia Stewart-Bertrand, with us today, but she had some personal health issues to attend to. And one of the questions that we were exploring is, and maybe you can help the audience understand, what is the difference between being a vegan and a vegetarian?
Yeah, of course. Something I'm happy to talk about, and I'm glad we get an opportunity to talk about it today. I think it's a fascinating subject. A vegetarian is somebody who doesn't eat any meat products, and that would include fish and chicken, so they wouldn't eat any flesh. But they may still eat eggs and or milk, and so you have a lacto-vegetarian, which is somebody who still drinks milk, or you have an ovo-vegetarian, somebody who still eats eggs, or you have a lacto-ovo-vegetarian who still eats eggs and or milk. A vegan doesn't consume any animal products whatsoever, so that would eliminate any flesh, including fish. It would also eliminate milk and egg and dairy products, as well as, which a lot of people are often surprised to hear, honey. And I take it to its next logical step, which I think a lot of vegans do, and I don't wear wool and or silk.
Wow, that's very admirable. Patricia and I had spoke prior to the interview today, and she comes from a province where meat eating is almost a religious event in Alberta, and that she was wondering in one of her questions here, what was it that precipitated your decision to become a vegan and give up meat in specific?
Yeah, you know what? I spent some time in Alberta. That's where I practiced law. So I understand what she's saying. It's definitely meat central. And growing up in South Africa, you know, there's a lot of meat being eaten there as well. I ate a lot of meat in my childhood. There was about 19 years ago, my brother, my older brother, introduced me to a book called Diet for a New America by John Robbins. And he is the son of one of the founders of Baskin-Robbins. And he walked away from this Baskin-Robbins empire, if you can call it that, and wanted to write a book that explored the North American diet and where we get our food and how it affects our health, our environment, and the animals. And I read the book, and the very next day became vegetarian. I then started to read more and more about our food and where it comes from and what's involved in getting it on our tables, and about a year later became vegan.
I see. I think Sandy has got a follow-up question on the train of thought that we're on. Sandy, please go ahead.
I do, Josh. I wanted to know how, if you don't take in any dairy, eggs, milk, meat, how do you make sure that you get the protein that you need in your diet?
Yeah, you know, and that's such a great question, because it's the first question that anybody who I talk to about this asks me. And I think what the beef, the meat, and the dairy boards have tons of cash. They're good lobbyists, and they're also very good at PR. So I think they've presented it in such a way that we need animal protein in order to remain healthy. And in actual fact, that's a little bit of a misnomer. Animal protein is acidic. Our bodies are naturally alkaline. They're about a 7.5 on the scale. And so when we consume more animal protein, our bodies become more and more acidic. And in order to
get back to their natural alkaline state, there needs to be a base to carry to get rid of all that excess protein. So in actual fact, overconsumption of animal proteins and acidic protein from animal protein will result in a loss of calcium from the body. And so, which is why in North America, we have some of the highest levels of osteoporosis in the world. And animal protein in and of itself has been linked to 4 out of 5 of the top causes of death in North America, including heart disease and obesity and diabetes. So for me, what I did was I looked at, and I researched this because I don't think you can just cut out meat and expect that you'll be okay. I really think you have to eat a balanced diet. So I researched and I found that protein in non-animal sources, in plant foods, is abundant. Broccoli is about 20% protein. Spinach is up there as well. And then legumes, chickpeas, lentils, black beans, etc., have significant amounts of protein. And things like, and then of course your tofu and what have you, or other sources of protein, as well as nuts and certain grains, like quinoa, for example, is a wonderful grain. It's an ancient grain, and it is about 30% protein. So there's a lot of sources out there. And what I did was I just realized that instead of just eating chicken or fish or beef or whatever, I then opened up, my palate opened up to a wider variety of foods, and I think I eat far more broadly and far more diversely now than I ever did as a meat eater.
Did you have any kind of withdrawal whenever you quit eating meat? Did you have any kind of withdrawal symptoms that, you know, were noticeable to you?
You know what? The first thing I noticed is I just had more energy. I thought there might be some things that might, you know, if you quit drinking coffee, you start to get headaches, right? So I thought maybe
right.
Something like that was going to happen. But the exact opposite happened. I started to feel better. The withdrawal symptoms were all good. I started to feel lighter. I started to feel like I had more energy. My skin cleared up a little bit more. I just felt more light and energetic, I think, is probably the best way to describe it.
Great.
Well, that's very interesting because Sandy works in the medical field in Georgia. She works with a number of doctors. She's interested in both medical science as well as in science like astronomy and other sciences. And Sandy, you've had some experience with people that have had problems with their digestive tracts from the consumption of meat products.
I work for a gastroenterologist, and obesity is a big problem in the United States and all over, but our diets are terrible, and if obesity is a big cause of health problems, people just don't realize it, but diabetes and it really is hard for people to cut back and not eat those things.
And unfortunately, it's sort of a vicious cycle because a lot of people who are impoverished don't have either the education or the finances to buy good food. And so they end up going and buying McDonald's or KFC or Burger King or fast food. And, of course, fast food is what is slowly killing them. So it's a really vicious and unfortunate cycle. There was a wonderful book called The China Study written by, I forget the author's name. I'll get it in a second here. And it was one of the largest studies ever on diet and health. And it was by Colin Campbell. And some of the conclusions he reached in that were exactly as you were saying, Sandy, that eating a standard American diet is linked significantly to various health diseases, including obesity, heart disease, atherosclerosis, cancer, diabetes, etc.
Wow. Well, I had a slightly different question. A member of my family, who I'll leave unmentioned, went down the path of becoming a vegan, but I'm not going to say he or she. I don't want to single them out, but they didn't really research it. They just thought, you know, I'll just eat greens, and they didn't obtain enough protein in their diet, and this member of my family became hospitalized as a result of not following the diet. So being a person who's been practicing this for nearly 2 decades, what advice would you give to people that want to pursue this lifestyle before they just jump right in?
I think educate yourself. It's just like anything, really. You just get a good book. There's a number of when I first became vegetarian or as a vegan, there was not a lot of options out there. We didn't have Whole Foods. We didn't have a ton of the products that we have available now, imitation meats, et cetera, et cetera. So I was forced, and of course the internet wasn't around, so there wasn't information available to me as easily as there is now. So there's a number of great sites available online. Vegetarian Resource Group operates a wonderful site. Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine operates a 21-day sort of guide to be transitioning to vegetarian diet. And then, of course, there's some great books that have been written about transitioning to a vegan or vegetarian diet. So I think that's the key, is just is read and then commit to trying different foods and really broadening your palate.
Well, one of the things Patricia was going to relate to you today, and I don't know if you had a chance to review her article, you know, she kind of set this up, excuse me, as a, you know, vegetarianism versus meat eaters. Obviously, you know, that was kind of a quote, and I'm going to put a pun in here, a red meat question, right?
Right.
Sort of audience. But one of the things when we were going over the research materials for your article was that people don't seem to understand the benefits of becoming a vegan, that it requires some self-education before just diving in. Otherwise, you can actually shock the body and cause some short-term damage, is that, or at least discomfort. Is that not a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think your body has needs, right? And we need a balance of protein, carbohydrates, fiber, fats, etc. So if you eliminate one food source so you eliminate essentially all the protein from your diet, you're going to result in issues. But I think the protein myth is exactly that. It's more of a myth. I think for me the crucial issues are, because I don't know that I've ever heard of anybody sort of dying from a protein deficiency. You know, we talk about people not getting iron or calcium or B12 or those essential nutrients. So I think those are the things you really have to be careful about, and just make sure that, and I think this applies to anybody, just make sure you're eating a lot of greens. Greens, if your fruit is green, it's generally going to be very, very good for you.
Well, if you did read her article, Patricia is actually going to go vegan.
Yeah.
For 30 days. And that kind of leads into, which when we were debating it, I said, wow, you know, and she pointed me to a number of research articles that from a number of universities about the benefits of a healthier lifestyle and staying away from chicken McNuggets and, you know, French fries and things of that nature. I can't say that I've made the decision yet, but I am being swayed. So she's going to give it a 30-day try to see if she feels better, and you may have made a convert by the research that we did on your program here today.
Well, you know what, Ken? This is the way I look at it. It's a decision that I made, and I'm certainly not out here to tell anybody that they should be doing this or doing that. I know that it worked for me, and all of the information I have available to me and all the information I've read suggests that it's definitely a much healthier way of eating. So in terms of our health, it's phenomenal. In terms of the environmental degradation that is involved in factory farming is obscene. It really is. And so there's that aspect.
And then, of course, for me, one of the crucial decisions in terms of becoming a vegan was the animal rights decision. It was something that, for me, I didn't want to be involved in anymore. So there's a number of reasons why people become vegetarian or vegan, and for me it was threefold. It started off as an ethical decision, but certainly once I found out about the environmental and health aspects of it, it merely confirmed to me that this was, in fact, the right way for me to eat.
Well, you mentioned two key words that I wanted to ask you about next, and that was factory farming. And to come off the cuff here, you know, the amount of agricultural product that needs to go into creating a pound of beef that's eaten by a human being is just astounding. The second part of this discussion of being a vegan and looking at a different lifestyle for people to consider is, can you share with us a little bit about the, and I'm going to use a strong word here, the horrors of factory farming?
Yeah, of course.
I'm speaking of animal cruelty in specific.
Yeah, I think when I look at it, I think it really is a factory. These animals are caged up. They're injected nonstop with antibiotics and chemicals because they need to sell them cheaply. So if you can get a cow to, or a chicken or something to double its size, or to gain weight faster, then those steps will be taken. But beyond that, there's a number of horrors that are inflicted upon these poor creatures. And for chickens, for example, it means that all the male chicks that are born are thrown into a basically a grinder or garbage bags and killed because they don't lay eggs, so they're not useful. And cows are I think the best way to describe it is they're treated horrifically. And there's a movie called Earthlings, which is narrated by Joaquin Phoenix, talks about the horrors of factory farming. And if you go online, and there's a group called Mercy for Animals, which has a number of undercover videos of different factory farms and the horrors that are perpetrated on these really beautiful, innocent creatures. And sometimes seeing what happens is the most persuasive thing that we can do. And the fact that we lock people out of factory farms, we don't allow access to them, suggests that maybe what's going on in there isn't right and isn't pretty. That's for sure.
Well, here in California, we've actually had a number of investigations by the United States Food and Drug Administration where they've gone into these farms, and now again, not all of them practice the horrendous things that we've discussed, but you've probably seen some of the videos on the web, particularly with the way that cattle are treated. And so there have been a number of investigations here in California. In the Central Valley, beef is, you know, big business, and there have been a number of arrests. So I myself look at this and shocked. And then the other part of the story that I knew about previously, you know, I still do eat meat, and I like to have turkey at Thanksgiving. I knew about, and I hate to name a brand, but, you know, it's out there, the people that make the Butterball brand and what they're doing to pump up these turkeys for Thanksgiving with the hormones, you know, to get a larger piece of white breast meat and whatnot. I gave up buying the store-bought turkeys a number of years ago, and I have friends that go hunting, and there's a place down the coast where you can hunt for wild turkey. It's not quite as tender, but we put it in the salt brine, we soften it up. But I just can't bring myself to buy another Butterball turkey because of the way they're treating these poor birds.
Yeah, it's pretty horrific, and I think if you spend any amount of time online researching it, it becomes more and more clear exactly how disturbing these factory farms are. And ultimately, for me, what I decided was that I just didn't want to be responsible for another creature's death so that I could basically please my palate.
Josh, hey, I've got a question real quick. About factory farming, what do you think about the antibiotics, the steroids, the stuff that they're injecting the animals with to keep the infection down or to make them grow faster, quicker? How do you feel that affects us when we eat them?
Yeah, I think it can't but affect us. I think what the China study revealed about that is that because there are so many growth hormones and antibiotics that are put into these foods, that, young girls are they're developing way faster as factory farming becomes more and more prevalent. The studies have linked to that. It also increases our propensity, or there's a link towards various diseases such as cancer. And because we're basically putting toxins, we're ingesting these toxins into our bodies. And it just makes sense that it can't be good for us to take in these. We wouldn't put those foods, those antibiotics and growth hormones in us directly, but I don't think we should take them in indirectly either.
Right. There's an argument that the antibiotics that they are injecting into these animals are causing these super viruses or these resistant strains of antibiotics or bacteria.
I think that's correct, and which is why even I stay away from sort of antibacterial soaps, etc., because our bodies are pretty wonderful systems, and we will build up resistance to various bacteria. But if we keep creating these super bacteria and these super viruses, as you're right, the strains get stronger and stronger, and then there's crossover and there's contamination. You end up with the bird flu, and then pig flu, and H1N1, etc. I think these are all of them are traced back to meat consumption and animal and factory farming.
Right. I agree with that. I do.
Yeah.
Josh, with regard to animal cruelty, are you involved with, or do you know of any, maybe your focus is more in Canada, but organizations that are working to raise the awareness of animal cruelty in the factory farming process?
Yeah, there's a great organization called Mercy for Animals, MFA. They do terrific, terrific work. Another organization called the Vegetarian Resource Group also does amazing work, and those are both based out of the States. And there is another one. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. If it comes to me, I'll mention it later. But I think if you link to those ones, they often will link to various other organizations that are doing really just terrific work in terms of revealing what exactly goes on behind the gates of these factory farms.
Well, what I'll do is after the interview this evening or tomorrow, when we do the follow-up to your news article, I'll send you an email, or you can send me an email, and then I'll hyperlink the organizations when we put the recorded show into your news post.
And that's terrific. That'd be great.
To help raise awareness. I want to thank you for bringing this to our attention, because we've got a great Stargate Universe fan who's called, and her name is Holly Wilson, and we're going to get to her in just a moment. When I was doing my research on this, and I'm not trying to be, you know, gross or macabre, but I ran into a type of animal farming that made my skin crawl, and it's going on over in Korea and in China, where they're actually farming dogs and cats. I don't know if you were aware, but in the last year, it became, you know, a lot of the top, we know it's a tradition over there to cook the dogs and the cats, but it's been going on for 1,000 years, and some video leaked out in the last 6 months of top leaders in this town. And I just, you know, this is kind of what I'm not saying guess. This is what really turned my stomach, because I was not aware that this type of activity was going on, where, you know, felines and canines were actually being raised for protein to be slaughtered in this town where they have this party every year. And I went on a Twitter rant for a couple of days about it, because I was, you know, putting links. So do you find that to be shocking, that you know, it's not just the cattle and the turkeys and the chickens, but they're also treating cats and dogs this way in some parts of the world?
You know what, Ken, this is how I look at it. It's I've been vegan now for almost 19 years, and I don't think anything shocks me anymore. Every month there's a new something horrific that's revealed, and I think the more we investigate this, the more is revealed. I've always wondered how not found it amusing, but it's interesting that we in North America we call some animals pets and others dinner. And that's a distinction that I never wanted to make. I just said, look, an animal is an animal, and they're all creatures, and they all deserve to live their beautiful lives. So the fact that it happens to dogs and cats in Asia is horrific. The fact that it happens to cattle and chickens in North America is equally as horrific.
Yes, I hear you, and believe me, it's really struck a nerve to me when we did this story. You know, this whole series is that we're doing this year, the 40 shows, is about human interest topics, and I think this is one that requires attention. And I want to thank you very much for spending your time to raise awareness. We're going to change gears a little bit. Holly Wilson, are you here? Ms. Wilson? Hold on, she's muted. Why is she not? There we go. Holly, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Josh Placker, this is Holly Wilson. She's
Hi.
A longtime Stargate fan and a big fan of Sergeant Spencer. Holly, did you have a question or two for Josh Placker?
I did. I want to hear a little bit about your new movie that's going to come out. Is it still in production, or are you finished, or how's that going?
Yeah, thanks for calling, Holly. Thanks so much for watching Stargate. Always great, and which is why I love Twitter. We get to interact with people who watch our shows and support us, and I think that's so amazing. So thank you. It's called Elysium. That is the working title, at least. I know on IMDb they call it Baja Dunes as well, so you never know what it will eventually be called when it's released, but we have wrapped, and so we're not filming anymore. We may have to do some reshoots, some new scenes, or reshoot some scenes that maybe just didn't get the right look and feel. That may happen in the next little while. As I understand, on Wednesday, actually, I'm going to go see a rough cut. Neil has invited me to go see a rough cut without the visual effects. So we're in
That's
the editing
awesome.
Stage. Yeah, and we're also in the visual effects stage. There is a lot of visual effects that need to be done on this film. So
how
exciting.
Yeah.
It's super exciting. It really is. Yeah.
What kind of character do you play in it?
I play one of the villains. I can't really say much more than that.
Okay, all right. That's fine.
Sworn to secrecy.
Okay, all right. Well,
be tapped in.
Yeah, earlier, Holly, you had, in the very beginning when you were having internet problems and could not listen before you dialed in, it's a film that's being produced by Sony. It's still under wraps. If you go to the news articles, there's a couple of promos in there. If you liked District 9, did you ever go to see District 9?
Yes, we have the DVD. Yes.
Oh, terrific.
Maybe you can do a kind of a District 9 takeoff and repeat what we talked about earlier.
It's a completely different movie than District 9. It's not a sequel. It's completely different, but it's it as you know, District 9 had a real sort of socio-political statement to it, and Elysium has that as well. It definitely speaks to some of the issues that I think are being addressed in society today or aren't being addressed in society today. So, and the cast is, of course, amazing. Working with Matt Damon was amazing. Working with Jodie Foster was wonderful. And Sholto Copley, who was the lead in District 9, he played Vickers. He's in Elysium too, and he is just an amazing guy to work with. He's terrific. He's crazy, but he's terrific.
Well, I'm so happy for you. I really liked your character in SGU. I have Netflix, so I watch it over and over again. You know, my kids are all hooked. They hear the theme music coming on, and they all come running in my room. But I appreciate you taking my questions. Thanks for calling me, Ken.
Well, Holly, Josh, if you look through your followers, I'm sure you're going to find a young lady, a lovely mother of three named H. Wilson, 2009. And she, like many, you know, we're all sad that Stargate has been put on the shelf for the time being. And we'll talk a little bit about that. You know, MGM went through bankruptcy, and they've recently received funding. There is some buzz out on the internet that Roland Emmerich, the individual who was involved with the first Stargate movie back in 1994, is back in the mix. And so a question to you, Josh, is although it's not likely that SGU, SG-1, or SGA are going to come back, if you were approached to be in a Stargate production again, whether that was on the little screen or the big screen, would you consider coming back into Stargate?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I really enjoyed my time on Stargate. It was a terrific group of people, everyone involved from production all the way through to my castmates and the crew were wonderful. I would jump at the opportunity to work with any of them again, and it really was just a blast, and it was sad to see it end. Even though I wasn't in season two, I still followed it, and I followed the stories and the characters, and think that it was tragic that it had to end so soon, because I think they were really making some smart, really gripping TV.
Well, you know what my theory is now. Sandra and I have discussed this. What we think is that Spencer really didn't die. We think that the beings and the cosmic background radiation grabbed Sergeant Spencer, and you're sitting over there chatting with them and having a vegan dinner right now. That's what we want. That's what we believe. Okay?
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Now.
That's
so
right.
One of these days is going to activate, Josh. We're going to hear the kawoosh, and out's going to come Sergeant Spencer. I think you're going to be the guru of the new movie. That's my take on this thing.
That'd be terrific. I think I joked with the producers that I was sort of they were just dragging me behind the Destiny, just floating out in space, just keeping my body preserved until it needed to come back.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, your role was really exciting there. Josh, is there anything that you would like to share about the animal cruelty and the veganism? I mean, obviously, you've had tremendous health benefits, you know, to go positively here on being a vegan. Is there anything you'd like to share as we come to a conclusion here today about the benefits of being a vegan? And please take the stage.
Yeah, and thanks, Holly, for calling. Thanks, and thanks for following on Twitter, and thanks for watching. It was always nice to talk to people about the show. I think the one thing I sort of want to leave people with is this: is I don't want to preach, and I certainly don't want to tell people what to do. That's not my style. I just know that once I started to look into it, my eyes were opened to the sort of the ethical dilemmas that are involved with it, and that in terms of my health and how we interact with the environment, I've had nothing but positive experiences since becoming a vegan. And you know, I encourage people to look into it and explore it and see if it's something that resonates with them. I know that the benefits will be significant for the animals, for the environment, and for their health. So I guess I'll leave people with that.
Well, Josh, I thank you very much. Patricia Stewart-Bertrand will be, to go on to a different note, conventions. First, we want to thank you for spending an hour with us today to talk about animal cruelty, raising awareness on being a vegetarian and or a vegan, your past lives in TV and movies, of course, the upcoming movie Elysium, which we're all waiting for. Coming up here in April is a Stargate convention. Will you be in the environment, in the environs of the what is going to be the last Stargate convention in Vancouver by Creation Entertainment in April?
You know what? I haven't been approached about that, so I don't know whether or not I will be there. I guess that is to be determined. If they approach me, it's certainly something I will look into. I know that I will be in Los Angeles at some point in March and April, but certainly I haven't been approached at this point. So,
well, the reason I bring it up is Patricia would like to meet you, even if you were not attending on stage or in one of the autograph areas. We understand that there's going to be kind of a reunion of Stargate people, even those that aren't appearing. Most of the guests are already booked, and being that you're in BC, BC, British Columbia, maybe you drop by the convention one of the days and give a shout-out to all your fans.
Yeah, you know what? I think I'd love to do that. I would love to meet some people in person. That's always a real treat and a real pleasure. And see some of the old gang from the Destiny, that's for sure.
Well, Josh Blacker, we want to thank you very much. This has been a very enjoyable and enlightening interview today. And I'll be in touch late tonight or tomorrow morning about some linking information to raise awareness on animal cruelty. And we wish you a pleasant evening. It's about getting time for the Academy Awards, is it not?
I guess so. I think we're red carpet time right now. And I always enjoy that. It's one of the highlights of the year. Just to, you know, I think it's wonderful to see people's dreams come true. You know, I think we all imagine ourselves at some point in time holding up one of those beautiful statues. So it's wonderful. And I would like to thank you, Ken, for your support and Wormhole Writers for all your support over the years. Always a pleasure dealing with you and your colleagues. And Sandy and Angie, thanks for joining us today as well. It's been a real pleasure and a treat talking with all of you. Thank you very much.
Very good, Josh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. We'll see
all right,
you
take care, everyone. We'll see you on the big screen,
okay.
I guess.
Okay.
Back against the fence. Oh.